Okay. 4, 3, 2. This is WZRD Radio Chicago, and with me this morning is Mitchell Sapanzik. Say hello, Mitchell.
Hello, Mitchell.
Hey, there you go. Yes.
Say goodnight, Dick.
Yeah, Mitchell and I were having a discussion about some of the music we were playing this morning. We're not being overtly religious. This is mostly for your education and consideration, but it does happen to be Palm Sunday for a lot of people. That's an important day. Not for everybody, though, and we want to make that really clear. Right, Mitchell?
Yes.
Okay, so we're here to talk about net neutrality. And the latest developments, in addition to other topics we're going to also touch upon that net neutrality has an impact on, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I really am starting to feel very passionate about in a way that I never anticipated me feeling passionate about any political thing with as much ire as I have right now about that thing, about that act. And then I also talked to Mitchell about talking about the upcoming election in Chicago, the runoff election between Chuy Garcia and Rahm Emanuel. And it really takes, but because I'm beholden to my background as a Christian, I cannot say unchristian things about the current mayor. So I will restrain myself from my bias. Okay. Mitchell, let's get started with what's going on in net neutrality land, FCC. You wanted to talk about the... Well, let's talk about you first.
Mm-hmm.
Introduce yourself, what you do, your shows on other stations, and your mission in life in 30 seconds or less.
Okay. My name is Mitchell Sapanzik. I am a longtime activist on media, not only on the policy front through a group, Chicago Media Action, online at chicagomediaaction.org, but also through my involvement in helping to create media, both for analyzing media and of helping to get stories that are undercovered or uncovered more out there. And so I have helped produce not one but two radio programs, a program called, ironically enough, The Ministry of Truth at WHPK 88.5 FM out of the University of Chicago. It airs Thursdays at 1:30 p.m. I produce Chicago Indie Media's radio program called From the Trenches, which also airs not only on HPK but also on WLUW 88.7 FM. As well as on Q4, an AM radio station and online resource at QUE4.com, I think is the website.
So is Q with a Q?
Q with a Q. QUE4.com. Yeah,
okay.
Q4 for short.
Okay.
And they are also broadcasting from the trenches.
Yes, and you know, I was looking for that online because it's, maybe this is also a subject we could talk about. I don't know, but it's really hard to get transmission of radio signals in certain parts of the city.
Yeah.
Welcome
to Chicago.
Yeah, and to hear your show is a bit of a challenge, and is just accomplished on, unfortunately, on the internet. And not everybody has access to the internet.
Sadly true.
And that's also a related topic to the idea of net neutrality, which is this idea of accessibility and us getting the information that we need unimpeded and unhindered by corporate interests. So thank you, Mitchell, for your introduction. Let's just talk about how we got to where we are right now very briefly, and then let's talk about the media, the human action that went into getting the results that we did just recently.
Yes. Net neutrality, just a quick definition, is the idea that internet service providers, the big, the Comcast, the Verizons, the AT&Ts, those companies that actually provide infrastructure for getting your email, visiting websites, streaming content, all sorts of things that have to do with digital media and the internet. It's now become our collective glue of increasingly of society. Those companies can't discriminate on content, nor can they discriminate on price. which is what they had been aiming to do to abolish the rule. And 13 years ago, they actually had succeeded by actually having a Republican-led FCC reclassify the internet into a framework that was much more favorable for corporate interests. So the wonky terms are Title II information service, which it had previously been, into a Title I telecommunications service, which is what it had been up until last month. This was basically amounted to that corporations had had the deck stacked more in their favor to a greater extent regarding what they could do, what they wanted to do, and how they could handle themselves in court going forward. They actually gave them a much greater advantage, especially when they were to face lawsuits that could undo some of what they wanted to do, maybe even all of it. And so this was the great terrain of struggle, not only at the FCC, but also a little bit in Congress, a bit in the courts, and also a lot in the court of public opinion, as I call it, where people didn't know what was going on because it's, you know, not very well publicized. When it is publicized, it's in extremely wonky, hard to understand terms. Even when they are made to understand, it doesn't seem like, okay, how's this going to affect me in my day-to-day life? I've got a job to lead. I'm not a lawyer or a telecom lobbyist. But yet, it nonetheless has very critical importance for your accessibility regarding content, regarding what content you may want to produce and share, as well as and I always bring the term home, discriminatory pricing. The idea that those big corporations, especially where it is now an extremely concentrated market regarding telecom access, mostly through cable and telephone providers, whose markets themselves are extremely concentrated, and where most people have one, maybe two options at most for their internet access.
Kind of like the beer brands in Cuba.
Oh, yeah. Perfect example.
It is a perfect example. You know, there's only two brands of beer in Cuba. I don't remember the names of them, but it's one brand or the other, and that's just about basically it. Now, you can... you can get other brands, and technically with the internet, you can get other brands, but they're not
There are a lot of variables into that equation. Yes, you could, depending on where you live, depending on what other options can be set up, depending on your persistence, your technical savvy. A lot of things can play into various factors of availability, and that's... yes, if you had enough gumption to want to try to get at that, you probably could make your way into that. It wouldn't be easy, and for a lot of people, including the vast majority of people who use and rely on the internet, it's probably not much of an option. They have to learn a lot more than they probably are willing or can commit to. It's like, you know, you driving a car, are you willing to learn everything about how an engine is built? I suppose I could if I were so inclined. I frankly am not. But nonetheless, I could still be interested in driving a car to get me from place to place. That I'm interested in. Same thing regarding the internet. Most people probably just want to be able to check their email or to visit a website and not necessarily know about packet slowdowns or... transmission protocols,
or HTML.
I do this stuff for a living. That's actually my day job. I can get into much more technical details.
And you know, and that's the thing. You know, that technicality is a barrier to entry.
That is regrettably true. Yes, and that has been one thing that the big corporations had in their favor, that they could just weave this vast technical web. Not only regarding the technology of it, but also the policy of it. I mean, you'd have to understand what is Title I and what is Title II and what does that mean and how does that affect media, you know, 5 years after a policy is passed that you hadn't heard about and that got a whisper of coverage in any in the major media or in any media for that matter.
And not to descend into conspiracy theory, but it has actually been empirically shown how biased the media is as a result of this corporate control.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's been amply shown and with plenty of evidence and with information to boot.
And great research.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of good research that can substantiate everything that we said.
It's like the little line by Mark Crispin Miller. It's not a conspiracy. It's business as usual. And for lots of reasons, which we can discuss. But right now, around the issue of net neutrality, yeah, this was a terrain of struggle. And I actually just... helped to produce a short film that actually chronicled some of the struggle over the, that, at least involving my involvement over the past 9 years. It was, I got involved in the fight back in 2006 when legislation came through to into Congress that would have sealed that 2002 reclassification into law without the FCC having a say-so in classifying it back. And that legislation was actually passed through both, did pass through the full House, and actually did pass a key Senate committee that would have actually put it, brought it forth through into the Senate. It got stopped there because of a number of breaks, but also because a lot of involvement helped to push a number of senators to ask critical questions at a key hearing on this score. If that involvement hadn't been there, odds are that questions, those questions wouldn't have been asked. Ted Stevens, who was the then senator of Alaska who was shepherding the legislation, wouldn't have sounded like a buffoon by describing the internet as a series of tubes. This is the famous remark about that. Yeah, he said that, and it was at that hearing. And also, it was one activist at that hearing who recorded it after all the microphones and media had shut off. It turns out it was captured by just one person, in audio form only. There was no video. And posted it online, and within 5 days of that, it got coverage in at least a dozen different media outlets. I mean, I saw it in the New York Times, and the Washington Post, and Wired.com, in maybe a half dozen blogs. It got play. I mean, to the point where now you'll hear Stephen Colbert make jokes about series of tubes. In fact, it's now become its own internet meme that's now become a little bit part of the vernacular. That came from Ted Stevens, and that came from a single activist involved with a community group called Public Knowledge back in 2006 that recorded this at a hearing where practically all the media had gone home. And it's like people say, well, what, I'm just one person. What difference can I make? This was one person who did make a difference, who happened to be there at the right time and at the right place. And who, you know, that led to such an uproar and an embarrassment that they never actually brought the bill up for a vote. They probably had the votes to bring it up for a vote, but they realized it was so toxic with the public, they just couldn't bring it up for a vote, and it died through inaction. The FCC, to their credit, did heed the fact that a lot of people more so were paying attention. And they did pass legislation, they passed policy that actually did try to enforce a net neutrality provision, but with one key difference. The underlying body of law that we could rely to, the Title I classification I mentioned back, stayed in Title I, and that basically planted the seeds for their future defeat. And true enough, the FCC, twice over, the internet service providers were engaged in violations of net neutrality. The FCC said, no, you can't do it. You are hereby penalized. The ISPs responded back saying, okay, we're not going to take this penalty saying down. We're going to see you in court, and we're going to defeat you. And they did. Twice. Precisely because, as the court in its second ruling acknowledged, you don't have the legal undergirding to be able to pull this off. And that was what happened. There were two instances. One, Comcast versus FCC, a ruling that came down in 2007, mm-hmm. that the Comcast was the party of play. And then again in 2011 with a ruling that came down 3 years later in 2014. The suit is Verizon versus FCC at the First Circuit Court of Appeals, if you want to look it up. But in both times, they basically said the FCC tried to do what they didn't have the legal standing to do because they had put the internet under a different framework. And that was the focus of the fight in 2014 going into 2015. And that was the big win that we had back on February 26th, 2015. Just a shade a little bit over a month ago at the FCC. In the course of 2014, what happened was early on, in the wake of this defeat, Tom Wheeler, who's the chair of the FCC and a former telecom lobbyist and fundraiser for the Obama campaign in 2012, had basically flown the white flag. He said, okay, you ISPs win. We're going to change the policy that you can have paid prioritization. You can discriminate on pricing all you like. You win. And once word of that leaked, even before it was actually announced, it was a post in the Wall Street Journal that announced that this was coming down. It was just astounding to see the rumblings by everyone. I mean, I happened to be on a number of national media activist mailing lists, and it was just, you could see it congeal into a powerful force. And then people were angry, and they're saying, we are not going to take this lying down. We are going to fight. We're going to fight as much as we can. We're going to fight this in every way we can, and we're going to see what we can do to try to undo this. And the linchpin to this was the reclassification back, the Title II classification that was undone 14 years ago, back in 2002, under a commission, most of whose members at the time are now not only lobbyists, but actually presidents of lobbying organizations. Michael Powell was chair of the FCC in 2002, is now the head of the National Cable Telecommunications Association, the NCTA. That's the biggest cable TV lobby in the country, and he's their president. Kathleen Abernathy was another commissioner at the time. She's now a part of the executive board of, and I'm blanking on the name of it, it's another big internet service media thing. Kevin Martin would actually become chair later on during his stay at the FCC. He now works as a lobbyist slash lawyer for a big, high-powered firm in D.C. Potter Botts, I think is the name of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're a big mover and shaker regarding Washington lobbying, and he works for them. And he had been not only an FCC commissioner during this time, but also an FCC chair for about 4 years. So anyway, that was the key of the fight. It was basically a lot of outrage against some of the most entrenched and financially well-off interests in America, and who knew how to win in lobbying. Very rarely did they lose. And people, including I, were taking them on in their own fight, and were doing what we could to help to make it an issue, not only with protests and activism and outreach, and also with trying to educate at least one of those three, one of the three possible swing votes at the FCC regarding legislation on this score. The Tom Wheeler was regarded early on as educable. He could be educated on this sort of stuff if he could be shown his way. And that actually was one critical component of the win on this, when the final history of this will be written. I'll bet you that they'll show that it turns out that one of the FCC spokesperson, a woman by the name of Gigi Sohn, who it turns out used to be the president of Public Knowledge. That's the activist group I mentioned earlier, one of whose members recorded the series of tubes remark by Mark Stevens. Turns out that Gigi Sohn, former president of them, was hired by the FCC as a spokesperson. And so she had an in on this and used that to her credit to be able to basically funnel in a lot of not only voices, but also policy experts to have a more of an audience at the FCC than they normally would have. And that actually would matter, especially where you will find that a lot of those policymaking people will be surrounded in their own kind of bubble and won't get a whole lot of critical information through. That, and especially where where not only critical information, but also advocates who will speak of that with some power and influence in trying to persuade you.
I think that's one of the problems that I have with this whole net neutrality debate in general, and is like it reminds me, because I used to work in the legal department of a large public actually wasn't a public, was a privately owned utility company in Arizona, and I worked in the legal department back in the 90s, and when you work in the legal department of a public utility company, you learn a lot about regulation. Mm-hmm. And you learn a lot about utilities and how they are regulated by various governmental agencies. But unless you're a stockholder of the utility company, you really don't, there's not a lot of public hearings about it. It's not as straightforward for the regular public, just Joe and Jane public, to go and talk about kilowatt hours,
right,
and electrical,
yeah,
rates and things like that. It just sort of is so technical that the people who do comment, or, you know, the public hearings are not public hearings for that reason, basically.
Yeah.
It's not that people don't have access to them. They do to some extent, but the barrier is the technicality of it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the fact that you said these former personnel of the FCC,
yeah,
and
commissioners,
lobbyists,
mm-hmm,
and commissioners, they are now, you know, in their bubble. And they're in their bubble because the bubble is this language that they all share that the rest of us, don't necessarily share.
Not just the language, but also the thinking on this. So they share the same set of assumptions and also the same framework about, you know, it's just like, you know, markets above all. And you can try to maybe tweak them a little bit in better ways, but not getting more beyond that or in thinking in entirely different ways. But nonetheless, going back to the net neutrality issue, there was this, the bubble was burst to some extent, not only because of some insiders who were able to funnel in some information to help to shape the debate in there, but also the resounding response on this. The FCC early on had opened a docket where they were basically going to revisit the internet, whether they were going to either cave in or do something better. And the odds of that early on were rather a long shot. One big win that came in early June was that Title II was put on the table. That is no small achievement, and it was because of the fact that lots of people were chiming in on this. Per FCC policy, they had to open a docket where you get 2 months to be able to comment in on a window, and then a follow-up 2 months where you can respond to those comments in the first round. And so it's a four-month window of opportunity to talk. That's how the FCC crafts their policy. That's how they take public input on policy. Most of the time, that doesn't amount to a hill of beans. A lot of times, it's just pro forma. Very few dockets get more than like 100 comments.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, this broke the all-time records for popularity of any single docket in the FCC's 80-year history, going back to when the FCC was founded in 1934. This is your new number one. More than 4 million comments, not only in the early rounds, but also in the later rounds, were filed in on any single docket. That is astounding. And that is, you know, a magnitude that shocked people probably at the FCC. To no small extent helped by a very vigorous grassroots campaign, a lot of political activism, a lot of protests, including some that were here in Chicago. There was one that one friend of mine recorded a short film about at the FCC's Midwest Bureau, which is in, I want to say, Park Ridge, right outside in the Chicago suburbs. There was also another follow-up protest, part of a coordinated national series of protests in November, right, where further rounds regarding the actual crafting of policy was going to happen in 2014 in Chicago, but also in probably 80 other cities across the United States, all coordinated within the same day. I think it was like November 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, there was a lot of movement on the score, a lot of involvement, and that also helped. I mean, it was the wins that we've had at the FCC, and frankly at anything, have been because people knew about this and that people have spoken up about this. Knowing about it is critical to net neutrality, it turns out, because the internet has been used as a resource for people to help to get the word out. And that's been the case for a lot of the political activism that we've had on media issues in the last decade or so. And to no small extent, because we've had this medium where we can freely share with a lot of people and very, very quickly organize and mobilize. And that's, yeah, and Lord knows that the big corporations want to put a stop to that. And then net neutrality is a way to do that, price you out of the game. I mean, why can't most people buy ads to be able to, well, I don't know, advertise for a mayoral election, let's say? But the reason is because they're too expensive.
Exactly.
I mean, most people aren't going to have $70,000 lying in their cushions of their couch to be able to buy an ad on.
You never know. Maybe my aunt.
Oh, okay, great. You can buy an ad. But, I mean, that's the point here, is in that game, which reaches a lot of people and can make a big difference, most people are understandably priced out, far less so with the internet. Yes, there are costs, but, I mean, I think you can afford to pay a web service provider $160 for server space and a website, rather than the $70,000 it may take to buy one 30-second ad on the Chicago television airwaves on commercial television. But nonetheless, you could reach a lot of people with that $160. Making a website and promoting it to the hilt, and also coming up with clever content that can perpetuate itself regarding publicity, the whole viral phenomenon, as it's called.
And the long tail and findability issues as well, because, and there is another topic that we will table for another discussion, because it's just, we don't have a lot of time.
Right.
And that is the recent FTC Federal Trade Commission's report that was leaked to the Wall Street Journal about trade practices with Google.
Yes.
And basically how in some cases not only the internet service providers but the content providers
yes.
are also calling the shots as to who finds what on the internet.
Not to go too far afield on that, but the phenomenon is richly documented there. You find concentration on a lot of scores regarding internet content providers as well. The proverbial Googles, Facebooks, Twitters, Apple, Amazon. The concentration is not just in the internet service providers, but also in the content providers. The book Digital Disconnect by Bob McChesney talks about this in much more great detail if you're interested in following up on the details.
Thank you.
Sure. Just to continue on with the net neutrality saga and our role to win victory here. So in October and November, things were starting to congeal. The comment period had ended. Things were starting to congeal on the policy front. Early November, Democrats basically get their butts handed to them in the midterm elections. And there's now regarded as an increasingly hostile environment regarding policies that might have a veneer of support regarding the Democratic Party. At least regarding Congress. I would read this as a kind of middle finger to that win on the midterm elections, because not 2 weeks after those, a statement released by the White House, made by President Obama himself, basically calls for the support of net neutrality and specifically for the classification of the internet back to Title II. The FCC had this basically threw the FCC for a loop, as far as I can tell. What they had probably had the policy ready to release probably later that month, mm-hmm. but yet it was like, okay, now what? And so what wound up happening was they didn't actually release anything for another 3 months thereafter. Gigi Sohn herself had basically said, it'll have to happen after the New Year's. It didn't happen until late February when it was released. And I think that was one reason why. A lot of that bleed over regarding the public comment of the FCC also bled over to the White House. And they read this is a huge issue. People are animated. People are concerned. People are writing articulate reasons that aren't just a kind of rubber stamp mail in a postcard campaign that you might see for a lot of political activist groups that would try to gin up support regarding one or another campaign. This is genuine. It is grassroots and people care.
And dare I say, Mitchell, it is also bipartisan.
And bipartisan too.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because, you know, even the right wingers need to get access.
There has not been as much of that, but there is an element. There is certainly an element among people and groups who might more align themselves with the Republican Party, who are also scared to death about this because they know that they could face the same price out. And so they're understandably concerned too.
Yes. But your passion does speak to the passion of, you're just hitting the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that a lot of political, you'll learn a lot in workshops about political activism. One person who sends a letter to a congressman usually represents at least 100 constituents that vote.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the folks and the powers that be at FCC, as well as the other side of this debate, looked at those comments and said, okay, that's 4 million people.
Times 100.
That's a lot of people.
That's probably more people than there are in the United States.
Probably.
U.S. Census had this classified in 2010 about 320 million people. So there are 80 million people who don't exist in the United States who voted in on this by that arithmetic.
Maybe they weren't from the United States.
I mean, this has also had an international ramifications. But going back to finishing up the story.
Sure.
So November, December, now January rolls around. We're now getting signs that it looks like the FCC is actually going to support a not only a new classification of the internet, but also one toward net neutrality. We're seeing hints of surrender by the big ISPs. Sprint has basically said, we're okay with Title II. Verizon basically tells their stockholders, we'll be able to carry out business as usual. Maybe not as they want, but as usual, under a Title II regime. Comcast has been making huffing and puffing noises, but they're kind of stuck because they've got a merger pending at the FCC. They want to buy out Time Warner Cable, and they need the FCC's approval about that. We'll talk about that in a bit.
Okay.
But they're kind of ham-tied. It was their lawsuit that basically opened the doors regarding, and they won at the FCC against the FCC in a DC court. But now they're waiting on this Plum merger to complete, and in something that they'll approve, odds are they probably will. But they can't do anything in the meantime, and so they're kind of just coy about this. In the meantime, they can't respond about this, or along the lines of we'll just wait until the merger happens, then we'll sue. They've made noises about this effect, and I'm thinking, well, that's really cocky. You're not good. You're assuming the merger may come through, and it may not. There's been a lot of heat on that score.
Well, you know, I should do more research. Honestly, I should do more research on who is on the Comcast board. But but this kind of this level of arrogance is very typical of most American corporations, really seriously.
Yeah, yeah. So, but nonetheless, they're reading hints of surrender. The FCC is basically reading the writing on the wall, and they're crafting a policy. The details of the policy have yet to be formulated, but it looks like they're going to do it. And on February 26th, 2015, in a very well-publicized vote, the FCC votes by a 3-2 margin to reclassify the internet under Title II provisions. It's not until about 3 weeks later that the actual text of what they voted for was released. It was a document. You can actually download it from the FCC's website at fcc.gov. The order itself came in a PDF file 400 pages long, most of which is kind of supplementary detail, a lot of the history, a lot of the supporting appendices to explain the legal basis and bindings for it, a lot of supplementary information, and also commentary by each of the voting commissioners. There's a lot of supplementary information in this big 400-page document. The gist of it comes down to about 8 pages regarding a lot of the details on not only what they did, but also how they did it.
Okay, Mitchell, I have to remind you that it is at 10 o'clock a.m. Central Standard Time here in Chicago, and you are listening to WZRD Chicago 88.3 FM. And just also to review that the views and opinions expressed during the broadcast day are not necessarily those of WZRD, its management, or Northeastern Illinois University. And we also welcome your comments and suggestions on our programming, as well as any letters of support, and invite you to contact us via email. Yes, I'm reading that. And it is our musical segment where we can take some calls from whoever might be listening. The number here is area code 773-442-4578. We are going to start and we'll listen to some music for about 5 minutes, and then we will return to Mitchell Sapanzik talking passionately and in an erudite. You know, I have dyslexia, just so you know, and that leads to me sometimes mispronouncing words, but I welcome corrections from all sources. Anyway, the number again is 442. See, I was getting my numbers mixed up.
4578.
Yes, thank you, Mitchell.
Welcome.
All right. And I'll have more coffee in the interim. So let's listen to some music, and hopefully if you have any burning desire to make a comment or question what we have, or even if you want to take up an opposite position. Ah, there we got a caller. So we're going to turn on the music now. More Willie Pickens. WZRD.
Did they hang up?
Nope.
Went to voicemail?
Nope. You know, whatever.
Up, oh, they're there.
WZRD. Hi. Hey, Jim, how are ya? The Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Partnership. What's the Transatlantic?
I know about that too.
Oh, okay. Right, exactly. And we are going to be talking about that, Jim. That's because I've been discussing the Trans-Pacific Partnership because I've been listening to it on the Tom Hartman show, and also with friends of mine. And I've been thinking, I haven't really read any text about it, like any legal law, but I know, you know, I've worked in the law business long enough to know why they're trying to ram this through. But yes, we'll address that definitely. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, did you have a question for Mitchell? I could hand over the phone and you can talk to him directly if you have any questions. Okay. Oh, okay. Well, what we're talking about right now is just all the activism that went up to the decision that the FCC published on February 26th of this year, and the history behind that, and what happened with the reclassification battle, the large number of comments, and then also looking at the decision, the text of the decision itself, which you can locate on the FCC.gov website. So if you want to learn more, you know, everything you ever wanted to know about net neutrality, it's in that document. But yeah, we are discussing ancillary issues in addition to net neutrality. And that's definitely, thank you for bringing that up. And thanks for calling and thanks for listening. Okay. All right. Bye, Jim. Thanks. One of my regulars.
Very cool.
So yeah, I definitely want to talk about that because Absolutely. That is something that's just making my eyes turn into little pinwheels. You know. All right. So we got one call.
Excellent.
Yeah, Mitchell, this is great. It's really good.
I've got the history regarding the Transatlantic Partnership, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP.
Oh, yeah.
This is how Ireland and New Media had a feature which we reported on from the trenches late last year. I mean, reread the headline.
Let's talk about that too, because I think I definitely want to talk about that.
Absolutely.
I definitely want to start.
TTIP is the name of it.
Yeah, I definitely want to. You know, I've been doing this teaching about net neutrality over the last year and bringing you in and also doing occasional quarterly issues shows devoted to the topic. But now I really want to focus in on these two TTIP and Trans-Pacific because one of the things that just dawned on me about it is it really does seal the deal in terms of my mind about how we're not really a democracy, we're really a corporatocracy, and that the corporations really run the show, and that we don't really, the government is kind of, you know,
they're an ancillary, ancillary appendix.
Right, exactly.
And there is fight among us, and we can win.
Well, you know what? That's why I think there has to be some resistance, kind of like.
There's been a lot of it.
the Gauls and the Romans.
I will dive on this sword, and my blood will spew on these rocks.
Yeah.
Until these walls are smeared with the last drops of my blood, I will fight.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
We should do it that way.
Okay. Well, we could do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Not smearing blows on the walls, but you know.
No.
I made a donation yesterday.
What?
This is a bandage. I made a blood donation at Life Source yesterday.
Good for you.
They took a 12th of the blood I have.
Oh, I can't give blood because I have chronic anemia.
Oh, that's too bad.
Makes it. If I give even like half of what you gave.
You'd be in a coma, yeah.
I would be in a coma, but I definitely would be very sick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, we're back on.
All right.
And we're back on with Mitchell Sapanzik from Chicago Media Action.
Hi.
Talking about net neutrality, among other things that are related to the issue of net neutrality, but we're just discussing the background that led to the FCC decision handed down to us in 400 pages or more. On FCC.gov, if you want to read that as a resource, which Mitchell says, and I agree with him, can be distilled down into 8 pages.
Yeah, there was a lot of supplementary information in the document, but the pith of the order came down to about 8 key pages, which basically spelled out not only what they did, well, number of things. One is the reclassification back to Title II. Basically declaring the scope of that regarding internet and cable modems, and also the framework of legal play. And this was the big thing that most of the right-wingers in corporatocracy basically lost their minds about. The fact that what they thought was just something that could be done with a scintilla of coverage 13 years ago, no one would know, no one would care. but would give them a key leg up regarding their fights, has now got undone, resoundingly so. Because it seems like that, you know, they pour in a lot of money for those lobbyists and to own those politicians, and suddenly the people who don't have a fraction of the money think that all they have to do is talk and they get their way. That's so frustrating to these lobbyists. Oh my God, my head's going to explode. But nonetheless, that's exactly the power that can be wielded by this, with organized people defeating organized money. And this is a key example of that. A lot of, not a few commentators have regarded this reclassification back as probably the most impactful positive decision the FCC has ever made in 80 years of legislation, where the FCC, for the overwhelming majority of its history, has been basically a handmaiden to corporations of one sort or another in one or another media industry, whether it be radio or television or cable or the internet. Now it's like a big middle finger to them. They feel they feel offended, and now they're kind of stuck regarding this. And so it's the scope regarding the internet of what they did, the reclassification of the legal framework back, which is going to help them when they get sued, and we'll talk about that. And as a matter of fact, they've already gotten sued twice. We'll talk about who's suing them and why they'll probably lose in a bit. Also, the particulars regarding where the law applies in things like, for example, bright line rules. So they basically set up the clear parameters regarding where net neutrality applies and where it might not. It also provides increased transparency regarding particular decisions. It basically provides no unreasonable interference or disadvantage for consumers or what are called edge providers. That is, those who would hook onto the internet to basically either traverse content or to provide content. They're collectively referred to as edge providers, and they're basically saying that nobody there, at least in theory, and as far as the law is now concerned, has any kind of necessarily disproportionate action. This doesn't mean that traffic management, as it's called, can be done. Of course it can be done. But this doesn't mean that you discriminate, especially on the basis of price. That's now forbidden.
Mitchell.
So that's a lot to unpack.
Okay, and also, I just also wanted to comment, in addition to that, we mm-hmm. have a caller calling about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, etc.
Right.
So we will handle that.
But great.
Let's unpack what you just said.
Okay.
Because it just already made my eyes go.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No. If you're enmeshed in this, you can easily swallow
right.
into it. But so, what are you unclear about?
Well, what I'm unclear about is, okay, what is a good example of an edge provider?
An example of an edge provider is Netflix.
Okay.
So that they provide content mm-hmm. that people will access.
Okay.
And probably that's been maybe example exhibit A in a lot of people's minds regarding the fight, at least in the last year.
Well,
especially
that's where everybody gets PO'd when their movie doesn't download.
Right, right. But the blame usually isn't on Netflix, it's been on some other internet service provider.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So that's one example. Another example could actually be the technical term is routers, but they basically serve as the technical connecting glue where you have some piece of information, part of an email, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
It will actually go from place to place to place to eventually go from where it lives on probably a server in California someplace into your email box that you view from a screen in, where if you live in Chicago or wherever. That there is, that you're seeing information that are encoded and put into digital components, packets is the technical term,
mm-hmm.
and sent from place to place to place.
Right.
Though the mechanism that transfers one thing to another, that kind of like serving as a kind of relay mechanism, those are referred to as routers.
Okay.
So routers themselves are also an example of an edge provider.
Okay.
Yeah. And so but I mean, that is also a mechanism for violating net neutrality. Cisco, the main provider of internet routers, as they're called, a big one, probably the biggest,
mm-hmm.
Basically was kind of in cahoots with the big ISPs because they basically said, hey, you want to discriminate on price? You need to be able to note the details of who's sending what so that you know who to discriminate against. That's our job. You get in bed with us on this, and we'll make it happen for you. But there's a little bit of money that has to be involved in this. So
right,
pony up.
Definitely.
So they were also in bed with this, too. And they were lobbying pretty hard as well to say, hey, we can get this, because they can score big.
Mm-hmm.
So that, but now, at least as far as the policy by the FCC, they cannot. So those are the great things about this. There is one small bone of concern that a couple of people have raised, activists, regarding the enforcement about this. So they've got the details of what you're not allowed to do. But suppose I'm Comcast and I want to discriminate and I'm going to just go ahead and do it. What are you going to do about it? There is some concern. It turns out that the details of the enforcement, there is some details in enforcement in the big 400-page letter that come to a paragraph and they basically amount to a kind of promissory note. We are going to enforce this. We're going to probably do this on a case-by-case basis. We may have an outside ombudsman. We may have an outside third party to help. But we are going to crack down on this. I don't necessarily read that as a bad thing. I suppose the devil's going to be in the details. It's a shame that they don't kind of outline the details in advance, because that would help things. But also, I think they don't want to necessarily freak people out, especially where, and they also maybe not necessarily paint themselves into a corner, where it turns out they may say, hey, we've got a great idea, but they don't determine it until like 2 years after the fact.
Or they may be wanting to work their way through the courts to determine the case law.
Right. No, that's the other thing here is that, and that's the other thing here, and we can talk about that. They did this. Not only another reason for the FCC doing this reclassification is basically to be able to save face when it comes to getting sued, so that they can win in the court and have a much better chance of doing so. That is almost certainly assured now with this reclassification back. And one big reason why there was this huge foo-for-all by the big corporate ISPs, because they'd complain about it, but they'd at least win years down the road when the ruling comes down from a court after they argue about it and win. But the problem is that now they can't, or their odds of winning on that score are much more sharply reduced. And the FCC, not a month after they have passed this ruling regarding a reclassification of the internet back into a much more firm public service oriented realm of law, has gotten sued. Two parties have sued them, and they are not the usual suspects. They are not Comcast. They are not Verizon. They are, and you probably haven't heard of these names, U.S. Telecom. This is one of a number of trade groups that comprise, it's like you will find in industries, various industries will, mm-hmm. even though they may have rivalries, they'll also group together to form nonprofit organizations that are thin veneers of their collective interests. It depends on who's funding. I mean, in the case of the oil industry, certainly yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Cokes almost certainly have not only a big say, but also a lot of money pouring into that.
And in the agricultural industry, mm-hmm. will have like, oh, the Council on Fresh Foods, or whatever,
Yeah. Yeah. But these are trade groups that represent one or another industry. In the case of television and radio, it's the National Association of Broadcasters.
Right.
In the case of cable, it can be either the American Cable Association or the National Cable Telecommunications Association. In the case of telecom, it's one of them is U.S. Telecom. And there was talk that one of these big trade groups would be filing suit mainly because a lot of the big ISPs are not really in a position to file suit. Comcast has got a big merger pending with the FCC. They're not going to try to risk that, even though it's probably at risk now already. But they don't certainly want to rock the boat even more by saying, oh, yeah, we've got a merger and we want you to approve it. Oh, and by the way, we're suing you. Not a good thing as far as your prospects go regarding, especially in a lawsuit they're probably going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to lose a lawsuit and they might lose the merger because they're irking off the people who are probably going to, who may or may not grant it.
Well,
not a good move.
As someone who has been a staffer in the legal services mm-hmm. business for a long time, you've worked in computers, I've worked in law.
Right.
I can tell you just from my own experience and just speaking off the top of my head here, but you have a deal that big, you're going to have a lot of roadblocks in terms of due diligence,
oh, yeah.
in terms of, you're going to have hired armies and armies of lawyers, most of whom, when they work together, even if they're on the same side, don't agree on even, where to put the semicolon,
mm-hmm.
much less,
right.
The entire deal. So even, let's just say that God's smiled upon the merger,
right?
There's still going to be a lot of roadblocks internally within those organizations
Under the best of circumstances, Comcast would have waited at least a year to get whatever they wanted passed. I mean, it was almost a little bit more than a year, about 14 months, for their merger back in 2009, 2010, when Comcast bought out NBC Universal. That was a big merger. There was a hearing in Chicago, which I had attended, and there was a, like a lot of pushback on this score.
And there were any hearings on this one?
We're in Comcast.
Yeah.
There was one, I believe, in Oakland, California. I think that is the only one. At this late stage of the game, I don't expect any others to come down.
Mm-hmm.
They may be figuring out what to do as far as their end game goes.
Right.
Regarding the FCC and probably the FTC. Comcast would need merger approval from both parties to sign off. If history is any guide, they'll probably get it. But this is different. And this merger has had a lot of pushback and there's been a lot of concern and the arithmetic may not play out. It may not be as cut and dried as Comcast may think because it would be a tremendously concentrated internet market, probably more so than I think the government agencies that are slated to regulate this are comfortable to have.
Well,
so that's one thing. That's one reason why my bet would probably be toward a little bit that it probably won't get approved. We'll see, though.
Yeah. Anything can. But we have to. But that just the. But see here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using a lot of buts. The thing about it is, the fact that they're even contemplating such a merger really gets my goat.
Yes.
And the whole idea, you know, of my understanding of capitalism is competition, you
mm-hmm.
know, and even why would you want to concentrate your market is my question. Why would they want to do that? I mean, isn't Comcast vertically integrated enough?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, do they really need to add another corporation to their portfolio of businesses? How would they benefit from this?
They benefit not only because their bread and butter for a long time had been cable television.
Mm-hmm.
Cable television income has peaked. The peak actually came a couple of years ago. Now the trajectory is on what's referred to as cord cutting. That is, people are basically saying, I'm going to pay, in the case of Chicago, upwards of $90 a month for...
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. That's my cable bill, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah. Or at least it had been until we cut.
Crazy.
Yeah. So it's just like, okay, I'm going to pay $80 or $90 a month for 1,000 channels, the overwhelming majority of which I'm not going to bother to watch, a lot of which is crap anyway.
Let's brush our doggy's teeth.
Yeah. It's like, you know, a lot of this stuff. I mean, that's, it's like a lot of people, I mean, and especially where, like, the good stuff, to be fair, there is a lot of excellent programming on cable television.
There is.
And has provided a lot of really good stuff. And the thing is, a lot of those really good shows, the Game of Thrones, the Breaking Bads, the Mad Men, the Boardwalk Empire, The Wire, all these excellent shows, a lot of people can get by other means.
Right.
And now actually we just had the announcement last month, HBO is now actually going to be releasing for, admittedly, Apple subscribers, but that's still a lot of people, a service where you can get HBO content without having to subscribe to cable, a service they're calling HBO Now, which is going to get unveiled next month.
So this is
going to almost certainly escalate that.
Mm-hmm.
So now you don't have to pony up for an $80 cable subscription. Oh, and another $20 on top of that just to get HBO, one channel.
And not to mention the dish things that you have to put on your house.
And all the technical headaches and all the infrastructure mm-hmm. and whatever else other headaches there. They have to take a day off from work to wait for a cable guy within a 4-hour window that, you know, I really should be working so I can make money to pay this.
It kind of looks like BlackBerry, you know.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, you see my point here is that the big reason that Comcast is probably shifting toward the internet is because that's where the action is going to be, and a lot of extent is, and that's when people are using the internet to get the big TV shows that they want to try to watch because they don't want to have to shell that out, and especially where they don't have a whole lot of say regarding that. I mean, if I buy The Walking Dead on Amazon, I can watch that anytime I want. I don't have to wait for it to come on Sundays at 9:00 in the evening if I am busy at that time or if something happens.
Right.
I can watch it anytime the heck I want.
Right.
And a lot of people, I think, are, I don't want to say spoiled because I avoid myself, but they have that expectation now. Now cable television providers and probably television providers writ large are now having to understand that this is the expectation, they've got to deal with that.
Well,
and one way to address that is by shifting the game, and probably why Comcast is trying to cement their place in the market.
And so you think that, well, and that's why they would want to purchase, I mean, and merge these two companies for that very reason.
That's a big reason. Probably not the only one, but it's certainly a big reason, especially where cable television is, I don't want to say on the way out, but certainly not in the continual growth trajectory that it's been for its entire industry's history. I mean, it didn't. The first time that the industry did not see growth was just 2 years ago. And since then, it's been on the decline since, and odds are it'll probably continue that decline. So what do? Well, they can try to pretend like they're king of a very small hill that is shrinking fast, or they can try to get ahead of the market and trying to go into internet, where internet access, where people are going to be using to get this content.
And no doubt they have an army of smart guys and gals like you trawling the data to really make use those algorithms to figure out where the market is headed.
Big time.
But you don't really have to know big data. You don't have to know about algorithms to figure out that, it's either $90 for a cable subscription or you could get what you need on the internet when you need it.
Yeah.
One size fits all versus tailor-made programming.
And it's only a select number of programs. The other fact about this is that most people, they'll get thousands and thousands of channels, maybe I'm exaggerating, but not by much, on a cable subscription if you get it. But the fact is that most people watch maybe at most, with any degree of regularity, by which I mean at least once a month, maybe 20 channels at most. Out of the hundreds, perhaps thousands of channels that you could get available. And they're just like, I'm not going to watch all of this. Why do I bother?
Right.
And for a lot of people, they realize it's not a bother. Or it is a bother, and they don't want to have to put up with it anymore.
Absolutely.
And especially where it's like, okay, I can do this a little bit of extra work, which with the internet has now become a lot more easy and is getting all the more easier all the time. Or you can stick with the status quo and nosebleed your money to death, so to speak.
Yeah.
So that's one big factor regarding all of this. But nonetheless, Comcast is now in a little bit of a hot seat. They're in the hot seat. They've got to try to act on this. That's why they're trying to get a merger. But yet it's a tremendously concentrated market already. This is not going to help if they buy out the number one and the number two biggest cable television providers in the country would merge and would become under the banner of Comcast if this goes through. And it might not. This has not gotten a whole lot of play, but there's been a lot of pushback, certainly among the comments that have been gotten back. The government is certainly not easy about this. Remember, it was just a couple years ago that AT&T thought they could buy out T-Mobile. These would have made the merger of the number two and the number four biggest cell phone providers in the United States. But yet, the government, seeing the numbers and also seeing a lot of the pushback that proposed merger got, effectively said no, and the merger got scuttled. I'm wondering if the same thing may happen here.
I have a suspicion that it just might.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, probably within the mid-2015 we'll know. It could even be as soon as next month when we'll get word one way or another on this.
Right.
The particulars are we can go into, but it would basically amount to we'll stop the merger.
Right. But this is why net neutrality, did play into this.
Yeah.
And so we have to really be vigilant about these kinds of consolidations, because it really does create a univoice.
Yeah.
When you think about any vertical integrated company, the media, we have five major media corporations?
In The New Media Monopoly by Ben Bagdikian, he had mentioned five companies,
right,
which was actually smaller than even the worst case scenario that he had imagined a couple decades earlier when he first published The Media Monopoly back in 1983. Ben Bagdikian is a former professor of journalism and actually also worked as a journalist himself in the Washington Post for a decade or more. But he became a journalist professor, first at the University of Georgia, then at Cal Berkeley,
right,
and then wrote about it very critically. And wrote the seminal book on media concentration called The Media Monopoly in 1983. And the book, which went into seven revised editions afterwards. In the last of those, published in 2005, I think is the year, called The New Media Monopoly, he basically counted the number and described in some detail the firms that were left, that were the big, that comprised the majority of what people see, hear, and read. There are five listed in that. It is actually expanded a little bit since that book was published because of some moving and shaking. Like, for example, News Corporation, Rupert Murdoch's baby, Fox and that operation, split in two. The Tribune Company, split in two. Viacom, which had been in charge of CBS, has split in two. But you've also had mergers. Comcast bought out NBC Universal.
Right.
So they shift. The number hovers at about 6, plus or minus 1. But it's and it really hasn't shrunk beyond that. It expanded a little bit in places. It's more or less held steady about that pretty much since. But it's still way more concentrated than any honest market analyst or economist should be comfortable with. I mean, where you're supposed to have a diverse market environment, you've got humongously concentrated.
Yeah, and the impact is, you know, what can you get?
What can you get? What can you provide? If I got a great idea or a great song or a great story, who can I get? Who can see it? Who can read it? Who can watch it? Who can hear it?
Right.
And if you've got the windpipe of the First Amendment strangled by a half dozen vertically integrated corporations, the answer is probably not a lot of people.
That's brilliant.
Jeff Cohen's line. Cohen is an analyst with Fairness and Accuracy Reporting. His famous line
was
brilliant. The windpipe of the First Amendment strangled by like a half dozen media corporations. And this was in 1999 was when he gave that line.
It's true, though.
And it unfortunately rings true today.
Well, you know what made me, what started me on this trajectory, Mitchell? We will take your calls when the music is playing, which is very shortly.
Do you want to hold that question?
Yeah,
we can do that
I'm
now.
I'm going to hold that question
okay.
for now. I'm going to go back to music and take this call.
They hung up. They may call back.
That's all right.
Yeah, we should probably move to the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
We
don't have a lot of time. Sorry to
burst your
bubble.
I'm just thinking that if whoever's calling is...
there they go.
WCRD? Hey, Free, how you doing? It's Free Yippee. Okay, hold on. I'll let you speak to Mitchell directly, Free. Hold on.
Hello, this is Mitchell. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, they air Free Speech TV and Link TV and a number of other networks, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Absolutely. Thank you so much for calling and for letting me know. Mm-hmm. Right. No, and that's part and parcel of the issue we've been talking about, of increasing concentration, reducing people's choices or options or seeing what's out there. Okay. Yeah.
We gotta go.
Yeah, I'm being called back to start up the show. So I appreciate the call and I appreciate you letting me know. I've taken some notes. I'll be sure to follow up. Thank you.
Hey, Free. Thank you. We gotta get back to show. Okay. Yeah, I didn't want.
Yeah.
He could. You know.
I know. We gotta get back. And I've got to leave a little bit after 11 o'clock. I'm gonna.
No, and you know what? And Aaron's gonna be here.
Okay.
And
yeah. Let's roll.
I don't want to be.
Sure. Anyway, Trans-Pacific Partnership is next.
Yeah.
I got some stuff here.
Okay. And I do need to, just. I do need to do one thing for the wizard PSA wise.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, Mitchell, we're back. And we are talking about, and unfortunately music is done, so we cannot take the call right now. We're going to be talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how this all relates to it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll also talk about the upcoming runoff election in Chicago very briefly.
Mm-hmm. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a proposed bill involving governments and corporations being negotiated in secret with a bunch of negotiating sessions, basically along the lines of corporations above all, writ large, and in kind of the vein of the kind of dismal international trade agreements and organizations that we've seen, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the World Trade Organization, analogs like the European Union in Europe, and the Asia-Pacific Economic Council, I think is what it stands, APEC, among the countries of the perimeter. And there are, these have had varying levels of success, in quotes, that where the idea is that corporations have primacy regarding international law. and that governments, even if people were to chime up about corporations basically affecting like the quality of their water or the quality of their working conditions
or employment or
the media being too concentrated, they may take actions kind of like what the FCC did back in February, where they passed net neutrality bills legislation and the U.S. court may actually win on that score. As far as international concerns go, these would get struck down as basically being violations of trade, which is a euphemism for primacy of corporations to basically call the shots regarding their needs above everyone and everything else.
Yeah, and you know what that does? It makes my eyes turn into little pinwheels,
mm-hmm.
you know, of craziness, because it's way to go to a global corporate government.
Right.
And
the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the latest, or one of the latest. There are others as well. There's a Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP for short, TTIP, but TTIP is its abbreviation. That's another one, but that basically involves countries around the Atlantic Rim rather than the Pacific Rim. So they're basically trying to use those countries that happen to border oceans.
This is truly the World War III.
Yeah, but nonetheless, I mean, they're doing this because they're trying to do this as a kind of end run around popular sovereignty expressed through governments, oddly enough. So they're like thinking the way to get around this is, and with varying levels of success, the World Trade Organization has encountered, I mean, they're never coming back to the United States. And do you know why? 1999, the Seattle protests. Seattle round never happened. The first time an international trade negotiation session collapsed utterly, to no small extent because you had 50,000 people in the streets protesting vigorously against that. Lots of arrests, lots of direct actions, helped to enhance a lot of the fissures that were in the World Trade Organization and which caused the collapse. A Doha round that was in Qatar 2 years later actually did get off the ground, so to speak, but collapsed in flames 4 years later. Another round in Cancun, Mexico, that was supposed to launch never got off the ground. It was another collapse a la Seattle. You're finding that that's kind of where the opposition is happening, but also things like, for example, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. This was a proposed trade regime that was going to encompass all of the companies in the Western all of the countries in the Western Hemisphere, except for Cuba, and was going to basically put the entirety of that hemisphere under the same kind of corporate regime. It ostensibly got passed out, but it kind of also had its fissured cracks and collapsed as well. Now there are new attempts to try to get at this by other means, at least as far as a larger scale is concerned, involving not just a country-by-country basis, which is one way that these kind of corporating negotiations are going. You can't have the entirety of an entire continent put under these regimes because too many people will know about it. They'll fight and you'll lose. So you're doing it kind of more secretly, where the United States is maybe negotiating with Denmark, and then Denmark kind of negotiates with, Ethiopia, and then Ethiopia negotiates with Vietnam, and then Vietnam negotiates with Japan. So you've got a kind of linkage of something like that, where you're five countries in, and if you know the laws, if they're ever released or leaked, and can follow the legal framework. So you've got to be lucky, have skills in journalism, have skills in the kind of following the legal logic on this, and then also tying that into, oh my God, what are the corporations going to do to, you know, chop down all the trees or to give Comcast everything that we own? That's basically what's at stake here. The newest realms of this are the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is being negotiated by all the countries around the Pacific Rim, including the United States. And the TTIP, which is read from a feature that was posted on Ireland Indie Media. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, abbreviated TTIP, one example, has to do with a U.S. mining and gas company, Renco, which managed to successfully avoid having to pay compensation to Peruvian locals who were harmed due to pollution by their companies by successfully using a provision of the Peru-U.S. trade agreement. See what I mean? The United States had a negotiating country with Peru, with just two countries. So,
and I think Tom Hartman also talked about an example.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was Peru or Bolivia, trying to get anti-smoking legislation passed in the U.S. Philip Morris appealed to that same
agreement. the same agreement probably between the United States and Bolivia.
Yes,
but
exactly.
Same deal.
I don't know if it was Bolivia. I have to check my facts.
It was on the
Tom Hartman show. It is documented.
Okay. Not satisfied, continuing with the story, not satisfied with avoiding having to pay compensation, the company, Renco, has since demanded $800 million from the Peruvian government as they argue that one of the companies that they own, called Doe Run, D-O-E-R-U-N, was forced into bankruptcy due to an expensive pollution cleanup which the Peruvian government required Doe Run to conduct. So,
And this is a very typical strategy of large corporations to all of a sudden declare bankruptcy once they are faced with a mass.
Yeah. So they'll lose this, and so then they'll say, "Oh no, we're bankrupt. We can't pay for this." And then they emerge in a bankruptcy a year later after the heat is gone.
In GM, for example.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, these are emblematic of the kind of strong arm tactics. In the case of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it's worse. And we actually know this thanks to our good friends at WikiLeaks, who it turns out has someone on the inside, thank God, leaked out some of the details of the Trans-Pacific Partnership to WikiLeaks, who then has released it publicly. So you can actually read some of the body of text, at least as it was when the negotiations were when this was released.
And Mitchell, it is
frightening.
And Mitchell, this is why we need net neutrality.
Yeah, because I mean, who would I could
right.
In a heartbeat. I don't have internet access at the moment, but it's not that hard for me to go to a cafe where they have Wi-Fi, and for the price of a glass of orange juice, I could get on the internet and go to WikiLeaks and download the entirety of probably the 800 pages that were leaked and start reading them and start to digest them. And probably they're conducted in English, maybe in some other languages. I think I can fake myself with knowing enough legalese. I certainly do when it comes to media law, to be able to follow some of the logic and thinking of what's going on here and see some of the potential ramifications. And I'm just one person in my spare time doing this on a laptop with a connection at a cafe down the street.
Well, anyone can do that. And still, at this point in time, I mean, if we don't do something...
That's true. No. I mean, you're right. That is very empowering, and that's what they want to stop.
Exactly.
There's a whole saying regarding freedom. Use it or lose it. Mm. Regarding the Trade-Pacific Partnership, there's one critical component about it that is new regarding all of these shady dealings and trying to skirt local and national sovereignty and the say of people to be able to have a say in their own lives. And it's this. The Trans-Pacific Partnership enters a new element in that parties that could be affronted could actually demand tax dollars from the offending companies to go into the companies who are suing. And the treaty would be written in such a way that those arbiters, and they're usually closed-door hearings with maybe three judges, who aren't judges, but they're kind of trade representatives who play judges, and who would probably buy the bindings of that. Certainly the case in the Geneva courts with the World Trade Organization. They basically almost always rule in favor of the corporations who are suing one or another government. Here it would be not just suing a government, but actually saying your government has to devote your tax dollars to this company. It's not a lawsuit anymore. It's a funnel of tax dollars directly from the government that's being offended into the company that's suing.
Mitchell, honestly, when you tell me this and when I hear about this, I think, well, it's just stating the obvious.
And this is more than just stating the obvious. This isn't they're trying to ramp things up because I think that they not only do they think they can get away with it, but also because they think that this is what they think they have to do in order to keep their profitability up. If they have to resort to this or these kinds of shenanigans, then they're really on thin ice as far as popular legitimacy is concerned.
Wow.
And I think they're right on that score. That they may not win on this score, and there's been a lot of pushback. I don't know. This is going to be a little bit of a fight because I don't think that the elements at play in Congress for the moment, the fact that the Senate shifted to the Democrats, who were putting up more of a big fight, certainly Harry Reid was, but we just heard the announcement Harry Reid is going to be resigning from his post as not only a majority leader or minority leader, but also from the Senate. He's hanging it up as far as government involvement is concerned. And the Democrats had lost their majority in the Senate. So the Senate is now going to has been under Republican control, and the Republicans are almost all agog for the Trans-Pacific Partnership and any other kinds of large-scale regimes. That'll probably pass through. It might not sail through because you still have kind of disputes among Republicans regarding this. They may still fall on their own sword regarding this because they've got their own internal divisions, and that may play through regarding these negotiations. Some may think it now doesn't go far enough.
Well, you know, it
and they may vote against it on that score. We'll see.
You know, also too, there are various interests of large corporations like Walmart and McDonald's, and to name a few. I mean, that they may have competing interests, and as they look to a piece of law like legislation or world legislation like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that may not meet their interests. So, you know. One of the things that just it brought back to my mind were the debates around the European Union back in the 90s, when they were trying to unify the entire course of Europe.
Right.
And whether and it's hard to say whether or not the European Union, as we think of it today, has really made that much difference in terms of corporate profitability as if it hadn't existed. So
that's an interesting question, probably more than we can really reasonably discuss.
Right.
And the answer and the answer is maybe not. I mean, we've seen collapses in Spain and Greece, in what they refer to as the pigs countries. There's Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, Sweden. The abbreviation gets spelled out with the word pigs.
Oh.
Yeah. and so
what does that stand for again?
Let's see. It refers to the initials of the countries that have gotten the stick on this, and have also seen collapse in the EU being too unified. The individual countries aren't in a position to be able to take action on an individual basis because they've got to get the entire EU to go along. And now France, Germany, all these other countries, they can't get on board because it's like, hey, we're part of this too, and we can't go in a separate course of action on this score.
Exactly.
Yeah, so Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, Sweden. The abbreviation is PIGS with two S's.
Oh, that's a good mnemonic.
Yeah. For lots of reasons.
Yeah.
But that's where these individual countries can't, you know, I mean, before the euro was introduced, you could see Spain maybe doing enacting policies on the peseta, or Greece on the drachma, or Italy on the lira. But now they can't, because they're now all under the euro. And so they've got to try to somehow convince the entirety of the EU to make separate actions, which even if you may be able to win that argument, and they may, they can't take, because that would affect the entirety of the European Union, probably about... it was originally 12 countries. I think it's expanded maybe to about 20.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So now you've got to, expansion's great. Now you've got to convince 19 other countries to get along board. Well, good luck with that.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean.
And that might explain why, you know, Greece and Germany are having it out.
Yeah.
You know, with regard to the collapse of their...
Yeah,
their
so Syriza takes power, a very left-leaning, it's very strongly left, political party that won elections in Greece 2 months ago.
Right.
And so now they're having it up with Germany, and in negotiations, Germany is afraid that they're going to default on debt that are owed to Germany.
And then kind of do an Argentina.
Yeah, doing Argentina, and yet Germany and then Greece is basically saying, well, look, we're kind of stuck with the short end of the stick here. What are we going to do about this?
Right.
We don't have a whole lot of options in our way here. We're stuck with the euro. We can't, you know, we can't dissolve from the EU. We're kind of in this pickle.
All of this has precedence in the European Union and getting all of them to work together.
Yeah.
So a lot of times it causes more problems than it solves in some ways, you know, for individual countries with individual constituencies.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I mean, the impacts of this are keenly felt and are affected on a national level, but because of this economic international integration, they're kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the, even when the EU gets passed over the protests of, and huge protests, I mean, I'm in Madrid, in Barcelona, in Rome, in you name it, there were huge protests throughout
the
2000s.
Too much about here.
Yeah. But I mean, there was huge. They were rammed through over the very strong objections of their populations, and now the populations are going to get shafted because the policies are like, oh, yep, that doesn't work.
And,
oh, sorry.
And this, I think And my opinion is that this is the same thing.
The TPP, yeah, could well be, if it gets that far. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a very real chance, because there's been a lot of very rigorous involvement. I mean, very few people remember about, and I think we should end the discussion about this and probably move on to the Chicago elections about this, but I'll finish on this point. The multilateral agreement on investment. The great days of when you could realistically have a good chance at trying to pass a single trade agreement for the entire world. The MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. It was sailing right through all the international bodies. This was about 1997, 1998, but it got scuttled and didn't happen because people were using the internet to find out about the MAI. There were leaks about its tax. People threw a huff. There were screaming protests in Congress regarding this. And we had objections from both Malaysia and India at the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, one of the international bodies that was basically going to say, okay, the MAI is in charge. We can close up shop and go home. They were throwing a fit at this, and so they weren't going to be able to fit it through there. And so they were trying to find another place to shop it around, some other international body that will basically say, okay, the MAI is now in charge, so, you know, corporations are in charge. We can pack up all the governments and go home. And yet it got collapsed, precisely because of the same recipe of people finding out about it, people knowing, working on that action, in speaking out, in protests, in you name it. And that spreads, and then that congeals, and then that forces a policy change. The MAI collapsed and hasn't been brought back. That was one reason why they had to go through the next step of basically going country by country through these negotiations, where the U.S. negotiates with Peru, and they set up a trade agreement in the dead of night that nobody knows. Mm-hmm. And so now anything, but they're also trying to connect them in through reciprocal arrangements. So now whoever Peru negotiates with, the U.S. now also has a pipeline into that. But the fact is that a lot of what, as bad as things are, they could have been a whole lot worse. And the fact that this is still in play is a testament to the activism that people have been doing in little actions, large and small, in everything from telling your friends about it to calling your local and national elected representatives and officials to telling people about this to going on the radio to talk about this stuff.
Absolutely.
And this radio, all matters.
Yeah, and speaking of radio, we don't have too much time left. I do want to cover the elections, and then I want you to once again repeat your website and sources for all of us.
Absolutely.
To follow up and do more homework.
Okay, so okay. Chicago elections.
Yes.
April 7th is the election day. There is early voting. I'll say some things about it. You feel free to chime in. One is that despite the polling that's been done, where Rahm Emanuel has anywhere from maybe a 4 to 11 point lead, I'm thinking that there's some, I don't think that's necessarily representative for a couple of reasons. One is that Ogden and Fry, which is the polling outfit that's been doing a lot of the polling, was actually shown wrong as far as their results go for the primary election that was held back in February, on February 24th. Now, they had Chuy Garcia with maybe, by the time their final polling came out, 24-25%. He wound up winning 34% of the vote in a 5-vote race. So they were off base on that. They were closer to the mark regarding Rahm Emanuel's. In fact, they were almost exactly right. They said he was going to finish with 45%. His final vote tally, 45.4%.
Wow.
So they were pretty right on that score. They do, by their own admission, mention two key caveats. One, they underpoll Latinos in Chicago. Their numbers of the number of Latino voters compared to whites and to African American voters in Chicago is not as big, but they are there and they are very active, and they are almost all, not well, maybe in percentages of maybe 60-70%, skewing toward Jesus Chuy Garcia. That is one thing that I think these polls do not reflect by their own admission. Mm. Second thing is turnout. The Ogden and Fry and probably a lot of others have been trying to get a snapshot of whoever happens to answer the phone on the days that they call. And those numbers, first off, that assumes you have a phone, which is actually not a foregone conclusion for a lot of people. But also the fact that the turnout is going to be critical. You may have a snapshot of what the overall percentage may be on a kind of statistical diagram where you have a mean value distribution, and you may be able to get a snapshot of, oh, we think it's going to be like that. But again, by Ogden and Fry's own admission, the key component here is going to be turnout. And you're going to have, I think, a much bigger turnout on April 7th, where I don't know what the weather's going to be next week, but I'll bet you it's probably going to be a lot better than it was on a chilly Tuesday in February, which had probably the lowest turnout in recent memory, maybe ever, in a Chicago election. So now the runoff is going to happen with what could be nice weather. I mean, even if it's warmer or marginally warmer. And when I came to the WZRD studios this morning, it was on my thermometer 30 degrees.
Wow.
But they're projecting warmer temperatures this week. That could be a factor. If the temperatures will be maybe upwards of 50 degrees, and odds of that are actually pretty good. It's going to projecting about 50 degrees this week. That will matter, because that will mean that people are going to turn out, and now they don't have to decide among five people to vote for mayor. They just have to decide among two. And the numbers there, and I bet you the numbers are probably going to skew towards Chuy Garcia. I have to admit, although I admit a little bit of a bias here because I can't stand our current incumbent mayor, mm-hmm. I like his chances, Chuy Garcia's chances. Mm-hmm. We'll see what happens on April 7th, but it will certainly prove to be, the whole world is watching, and we'll see what happens.
Well, definitely progressive activists of all stripes are watching, because...
And getting involved.
And, you know, and believe me, I have not really been interested in Chicago politics, because it's always the enemy that you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's been the daily...
The daily regime, now the Rahm Emanuel monster,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, well, you know, it's business as usual, mm-hmm. right? And what difference does it make?
Yeah. I actually, frankly, think I have a better chance of probably building a website to help craft a brand new economy than I do to win an independent campaign for my local aldermanic seat.
Exactly.
I mean, I work as a software developer. I built large-scale things. I don't think it's that hard.
No.
But it's not my bailiwick to run for office.
Right.
And where I'm trying to convince, there were 9,000 votes in my local aldermanic race, and I'm trying to convince 5,000 of them.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It's a long road to
yeah.
go. But you know, I think this is a. I think what energized me, and I'm sure what energized a lot of voters in Chicago, is this cloning of Chicago schools, because it had a direct impact
yes.
on people's lives, and it was done in such a way that did not take into consideration, in my honest opinion, of people who are impacted by the school's impact on the local communities.
Yeah.
I don't have children who go to Chicago public schools. In fact, I don't have any kids at all.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I was impacted by it, because everyone's impacted when teachers are thrown out of work.
Right.
There are no places for kids to go after school, and they have to shuffle around.
Right.
And it's not good for their education. It's not good for the teachers.
Yeah.
It's not good for the city.
And Rahm Emanuel has been kind of, you know, blown off the very legitimate concerns and protests that have come his way as a result of this. And I will bet you that will be fed into this election. It may have already fed into the primary. The fact is, this primary is the very first primary since we switched to nonpartisan elections back in 1996 that Chicago has ever had. And you know, that raised a lot of eyebrows. Suddenly, what a five vote nonpartisan election now becomes a two-person race. And where it's now, I'm not going to get into a discussion where I had in the primaries of who I'm going to vote for. I know who I'm going to vote for.
Right.
And I bet you that's the thinking of a lot of people as well. The question is, will the numbers be there? We'll see. The numbers are, there are some optimistic signs.
Here's what I think. I think regardless of the outcome, the action is more important. That people get out and vote, and that people take aim and send the powers that be in the Chicago city government a message that the way things have been going aren't working for the rest of us. And it's time for all of us to say enough.
Let me just conclude our discussion here with this last point. I don't think, while everything you said is true, I would amend it slightly to say that I don't think that involvement in politics should end with the election. Far from it. In fact, actually, my first involvement in political activism in the short was actually with the Ralph Nader for President campaign in 2000. After the campaign ended, I still felt like I had to be involved, but I didn't feel like that my place would be in the rough and tumble of electoral politics. I felt it had to be in some other realm, and it took me a while before I made media politics my realm of activism on that score. I mean, you have to try to find what you're doing, but my last bit of advice is to stay involved after April 7th on this score. It's like Bob Harris, who's a comedian and political analyst, had said a great quote many years ago. Democracy is more than what you do in a voting booth on a Tuesday in this case, April, but he said November, because most elections are held in November. But democracy is more than what you do in a voting booth on a Tuesday in November. It's what you do with your hands and with your heart and with your head every day, all year long.
And
do that.
Politics is personal.
Mm-hmm.
It is. The personal is political. And I guess that. On that note, Mitchell, we had this discussion a few weeks ago where we might have you on a little bit with a little bit of regularity, like with the change of the seasons or
mm-hmm.
something like that,
yeah.
to give us updates. And we will talk more about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, net neutrality, and other media action things. On a regular basis, on a semi-regular basis. Not that we're going to set up a show,
but
you know, we'll have you on occasion to do just that.
That sounds great.
And also to promote your show and your resources, so let's do that,
yeah.
and then we'll call it a day.
Okay,
about it.
My personal website is shtu.org. It's the first four letters of my last name, S as in Sam, Z as in zebra, C as in cat, Z as in zebra.org, or you can Google Mitchell Szczepańczyk. Szczepańczyk. More, a little easier to spell if you don't happen to be Polish, is the websites of Chicago Media Action, the group that I've worked with under the banner for activism on media, mostly on policy realms, but others elsewhere. The website there is chicagomediaaction.org. And the Chicago Independent Media Center, which I've served as a producer for the radio program From the Trenches, which airs on the fourth Sunday of the month on WLUW, on Thursdays on WHPK, and also on Saturdays on Q4 Radio, QUE4.com. Or you can also listen online either on iTunes, search for From the Trenches, or at Chicago Indie Media's website, where you can get the podcast and archives of shows going back more than a decade at chicago.indiemedia.org, spelled I-N-D-Y-M-E-D-I-A. Again, chicago.indiemedia.org. I'm also on the usual public social media platforms. I have a Facebook page. I have a Twitter account, actually. So does Chicago Media Action at Chai Media Action. Chicago Indie Media also has a Twitter account at Chicago IMC. And I have my own personal Twitter account at MSSZCZEP for Mitchell Steven Szczepańczyk. First initial, middle initial, first six letters of my last name. But if you look up Mitchell Indie Media, you can probably find me.
Okay. Mitchell, this was awesome. Once again, thank you from the bottom of my heart.
You're very welcome.
To coming on the show this morning and enlightening us on the developments in the net neutrality battle and the further world battle. The world battle!
The battle to save the world!
From media consolidation, this is Mitchell Szczepańczyk. Okay.
Hey.
All right, here we go. Well,
I've got my slingshot ready.
Believe me. That is a good analogy and fitting one to end on. You are listening to WZRD Chicago, 88.3 FM on your radio dial. Thank you so much for listening. It is always a joy and a pleasure and a privilege to serve you, the greater WZRD listening community. Now we are going back to our free-form musical madness. Again, thank you so much for listening, and we will close out with some music from Willie Pickens. In just a moment, please hold during the silence, and you will hear music in just a few seconds.